Blog Talk Radio.
Some of the guests on this podcast will express their viewpoints based on their own research, and those views aren't necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio, Cursed Net, Breakthrough Radio, or its affiliates. This podcast will also be available on iTunes under the keyword Cursed Net.
Hello, everybody. My name is Byron LeBeau, and welcome to Cursed Net Breakthrough Radio. Today is Monday, May the 18th, 2009. And before we start, I'd just like to mention a quick announcement. We are, in effect, offering new audio CDs regarding the Joe Jordan testimonies on the Cursed Net Breakthrough Radio. And it will be posted tomorrow, Tuesday, May 19th. And if you go to my website, inspectorblebeau.pbwiki.com, and scroll down on the first page on the left, you will actually find the second wave of audio CDs that are going to include six of the people we interviewed with Joe since approximately last December. And they include Joyce Ahrens, Kathy Land, Matt Kiss, Lynn Dickey, Nicole Malone, and Jackie Slack. So if you're one of those kind of people who rather listen to an interview of a radio program on in your car while you're traveling or not necessarily hooked into an internet, this is your opportunity to do so. We will be doing this on an ongoing basis. We already posted Volume 1 that included 12 different interviews. This is Volume 2, and we are zeroing in on the testimonies of Joe Jordan now, and with the number of very interesting people who are coming forward bearing witness to the powerful name of Jesus Christ. So we're trying to give you every opportunity to listen to this in any way that you feel most comfortable. Okay? Well, tonight's guest, who will be introduced by Joe Jordan, may be shedding even deeper insights into the dynamics surrounding the UFO and abduction phenomena, or looking at it through a critical scientific lens based on his background and training, and is currently planning on publishing a novel of truth, I would call it faction, to combat what Marshall sees as forces aligned against us who may not be after our own good. But first off, I would like to thank you, Joe, for bringing on this talented individual, whom I know is looking forward to showing his compelling experiences and as well as understanding regarding the spiritual perpetrators that he has come in contact with. And I hope you're doing well and are ready to go. How you feeling, Joe?
Oh, feeling good and ready to do a really good show here for your listeners. And Okay. We're, as you say, we're bringing tonight another unwanted piece of the UFO puzzle. And for your listeners that haven't heard that, the reason we call it that is we have the pieces of the puzzle that show what this experience is all about, but it's not wanted in the UFO community. It's a hated piece of the evidence. And I think it's because they know that they can't touch it. They know that this is something they have to look at. In this case we have tonight, Marshall is his name, and he has a fascinating testimony, and he'll take you through that, and he'll show you that he also has recognized the power and authority of Jesus Christ over these entities that people are experiencing through UFOs and alien abductions. And I think you'll find him very fascinating. I've spent some time talking with him. He has a very special book that he's working on and soon to be published. And Marshall, welcome tonight, and take it away.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah, this is Marshall, and I did suffer a pretty traumatic experience from the time I was 5 years old. My parents had gone through a messy divorce, and I started living with my mother in her father's house in Largemont, New York, which is on the coast and across from Long Island. And there was one particular night that I had developed a fear of ghosts, and my mother had given me a ghost stick and a flashlight gun that she said would be effective in if I ever saw a ghost to make it go away. And there was one particular night where I woke up in bed feeling as if there was something standing next to the bed, and I was in bed with some siblings and my mother. We really had to cram in because it was a small house, and I felt like something was next to the bed, and my flashlight gun was out of battery, so I tossed it off to the side of the bed to see if anything would happen, and it froze in midair. And I started crying pretty hard at that and trying to wake up my siblings, like my older sister and my mother, and nobody would wake up. It was as if everybody was drugged or out cold. And I just cried and cried and kept staring at this flashlight gun that was just floating there in midair. And that's all I remember. My memory of that experience abruptly, not abruptly ends. I can't really remember how that one ended, but I subsequently had nightmares at night that really were nightmares, I believe. Nightmares of being in the bathroom in that same house and watching fixtures come to life and cabinet doors slam open and shut, and the medicine cabinet, the shower head on the shower turned and looked at me, and it looked more like the head of the vacuum cleaner than the shower. It was ridiculous, and but I think I had these nightmares because my sense of what was real and not real and possible and impossible was just totally ripped apart from the time I was five. And
Okay, well, Marshall, this is Byron speaking now. I listened very carefully to what you were saying, and of course, you know, this, you know, as a young kid of 5 years old, having seen having a flashlight gun that your mother's giving you to protect yourself, and then it's freezing in midair, it certainly must have made you question what you were seeing going on. So. And then having the subsequent nightmares afterward, I can understand why you would be definitely troubled by this. Now, the first question, the most obvious question, is how did your parents deal with your nightmares, and what did they do to try to help you solve this particular problem?
I remember seeing child psychiatrists later, and they asked me to draw pictures of what was happening in my dream. And I drew pictures of things growing wings and legs and eyes. I also drew myself with no arms, which the child psychiatrist said was due to feelings of powerlessness. And, they attributed it to the stress of the divorce, which is sort of a credible psychiatric explanation, but I feel that the true reason was that I saw this one incident where the flashlight gun froze in midair, and I just had these nightmares to put the flashlight gun incident in a sort of confusing context where maybe the flashlight gun had been a dream, when in fact I really don't think that it was.
Now, I assume also that even as a young child, when you're listening to the child psychiatrist, was he a psychiatrist or psychologist?
I think it was child psychiatrist. I'm not exactly sure. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, okay. Well, just a point of order. Did you have either the sense or did you have a foreboding of trying to explain this very unusual situation to the psychiatrist, or did you just sort of like bite the bullet and not tell him about this, the flashlight freezing in midair?
I don't remember describing the flashlight gun incident exactly. It was just subsequent nights and nights of nightmares. My parents had initially thought the flashlight gun incident was a nightmare, and so when I continually described more and more nightmares, the psychiatric appointments were primarily about those subsequent nightmares. And there was nothing that particularly stood out about the flashlight gun incident.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I kind of...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Oh, I didn't particularly consider the flashlight gun incident significant after having those really terrible nightmares. It was like a coping mechanism to perhaps make myself think that the flashlight gun incident was just a nightmare.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, now you grew up in Larchmont, and subsequently you moved. This is obviously in New York. Now, did you move north or south? How did you move from that point as you went from one house to the next?
We moved to a town north of Larchmont. After our parents split, we stayed with our mother for a number of years. She moved to Irvington, which was the hometown of Washington Irving, who wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and Sleepy Hollow was right next door. I don't remember anything particularly scary at that house, but then we moved to Carmel, New York. Again, nothing particularly scary at that house, but when we moved in with our father in Wappingers Falls, that was when we started to first see the UFOs, particularly on one weekend where we were going to our mother's house for a biweekly visitation, like I say in the written testimony, a visitation of the non-alien sort. Aliens were the furthest thing from my mind, and we passed that UFO, that boomerang-shaped UFO, seen by thousands on that same night, and we saw it off to the side of the road, and we saw it on a different highway than Interstate 84. I believe we saw it right after Interstate 84.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I've been on Interstate 84. I assume that this is in the mid-1980s that you had this experience while you were at your father's house in Wappinger Falls. Is that true?
Yes, that was during the time that we lived there, and we were visiting our mother, who was in Holmes, New York, where she had a small cabin-style set up, and... We were on our way to that house when we passed this thing, hovering at about treetop level, and we thought it was just the top of a power line tower or something, and that the lights were there to stop airplanes from, you know, just so airplanes could see it and not hit it. And that's how we kind of, what we thought it was when we passed on by it. Then after we passed by it, we all seemed to think at the same time, what was that? Somebody actually said, what was that? I think it was me. I kind of turned around in the back seat and looked out the back window, and I saw the thing start to move out over the woods. And it started with kind of a sudden start, like it was bumped, and then it just moved at a real, real steady pace. You know, it just wasn't hovering anymore. That's as much I can say for how fast it was going. It wasn't going fast at all, but the acceleration was odd. And
now this ship that you saw, what are the dimensions of this object, and what were the colors of it, if any, and where was it heading?
It was about maybe 60 feet from the front to the back, kind of squarish at about a 45-degree wedge, so it was about 60 feet from tip to tip, or... perhaps not that big. It was less than 60 feet, about 100 feet up in the air. And it was big enough to be about one Cessna plane, but it was a bunch of individual lights, because I later saw it against a partly cloudy sky, and it was individual lights. Or a boomerang-shaped, skinny boomerang. You couldn't really tell. The brightness of the lights kind of obscured being able to see the actual shape of it, but it was definitely not like a Cessna, because a Cessna would have taken up the space in the middle. I wouldn't have seen any stars in the partly lit cloudy sky if it had been a single plane.
Right. Now, there were bright lights on it, but did you were able to determine what color it was?
Oh, yes. The colors were unmistakable. It flashed between... red, green, and white, kind of a diode red, green, and white, even though white diodes, well, I'd never seen white diodes in that year. I don't think they were invented yet, but the color of white diode flashlights is the same color of white that it was.
Okay. And now you did. Now I seem to recall your mother mentioned she had a peculiar reaction to this particular object. What exactly did your mother do?
She and I had the same reaction, which was to be excited. We were both excited. I remember watching Close Encounters of the Third Kind on television with her late one night, and we both kind of felt the same way toward UFOs, that they were just plain fascinating, and we'd be pretty lucky to see one. You know, you got Close Encounters with this guy just struggling his butt off to see this UFO way out in Wyoming, and you know, the viewer kind of vicariously experiencing that man's sense of wonder as he's trying to see this thing that he wants to see so badly. And that was where I learned everything I knew about UFOs up to that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So she signaled the UFO as you were heading towards her house. Is that the idea?
Actually, after we parked the car outside her house, and I got out of the car feeling pretty lucky to have seen the UFO once, and I was looking up again to see if I could see anything else that was unusual, and sure enough, it was coming towards us through the trees, and my mom had actually accelerated because she realized the UFO was moving roughly in the direction of her house, and she had sped up to get home in time to intercept it. I didn't know that at the time. And sure enough, it started approaching us through the trees. You could see it above the treetops. The light's just barely getting through, even though the trees were leafless. But sure enough, it was coming. And she signaled the flash. Yeah, SOS with the headlights right then.
Yeah. Well, as Greg Messina knows, back in last year around May the 27th, I think it was, one of the first program we did was a roundtable discussion among Greg Messina, Richard Stout, and myself, Richard being the co-author of The Cursed Net with myself. And during that interview, Richard actually presented us with his own testimony regarding what happened to him back in the early 80s. And it was somewhere around 1980-81, where his daughter was only 4 years old. He was out with his brother-in-law, and he actually saw a UFO, and not only saw a UFO, but signaled to it. And what he didn't realize at the time is that subsequently his daughter was affected by this communication with what he could only describe as a UFO. When he found out subsequently that his daughter had a cut on her in two different places on her body, and he was able to match up the fact that, in fact, she had not only seen the UFO but was abducted by them. And he felt terrible about this whole thing. And he did for the longest time until he finally came to the conclusion of what he felt this whole phenomenon was all about, i.e. the fallen angels and demons, and then did something about it. So that was a very powerful testimony that he gave on May 27th. So when I hear stories like signaling UFOs, of course, you had no idea, and I'm sure maybe your mother had no idea, other than seeing this movie and I think everybody has seen this movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that it's almost like a wow type of thing. These are good ETs, and they're going to take certain select people and help mankind through their contacts, and it leaves you with a nice warm fuzzy feeling. On the one hand, see, but then again, we got to understand that this is, in fact, the movies. This is science fiction. This is Hollywood. And then they don't always get the facts right when it comes to things, especially along these lines. So we can't fault anybody for that particular enthusiasm, but it's good to note that that is, in fact, what her reaction to this whole thing was back in the, what would you say, about 1984, Marshall?
The winter of 83-84.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah.
And as we know, the there was a book written on this subject, Night Siege, by Philip Brugno and Dr. Alan Hynek. And I think I mentioned that I put up on my website an actual essay that dealt with the full parameters of what was going on in and around 1984, right into the 1990s. And I was very curious to see when I read the expanded version of this book that Phil and Brogner wrote a second time around, the expanded version of Night Siege in 1998. He put together a whole group of suggested data that shows that there were over 7,000 witnesses to all of the things that were happening in the Hudson Valley area from the mid-1980s right into 1995, thereabouts. So it's a staggering number of groups of suggested data, and I try to catalog them in a way to show it was not just lights in the sky that people were seeing and boomerang UFOs that you suggested. Matter of fact, Kevin Unterberger, another person we had on the program, actually had a similar experience in 1984 on a different highway, but it was in the same general locale, and he was waving at them too, like they were his buddies, you see.
If you ever
listen to Kevin's story, he was on this past May 11th, but he was also on March 2nd. We interviewed him twice. And he went into detail about why he was so feeling so friendly towards these beings, because they had started with him at age 5, just like in your situation. So it's interesting to note the way that these things develop and the testimonies that people give, all different, but there are amazing similarities with all of them, you know, including the paranormal that seems to be part and parcel of this whole phenomenon. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, I wrote that essay. I wanted people to see we're not just dealing with UFOs and lights in the sky, but it seems that paranormal activity is a very, very large component to these events that have been taking place since whenever, you know. So, and speaking of strange things, after you had this experience now and seeing this thing in the sky, didn't something strange happen at the house? You were going to your mother's house to stay or something?
Yeah, and it didn't happen on that same night because that night, that particular UFO was busy showing itself off to thousands of people, but it was on subsequent stay over weekends with my mother at that particular place that I started to have nightmares of,
right.
Not nightmares, like night terrors. When I fell asleep, I would start to go into like a panic, and I would imagine that these mice that she had, they got in her house and she couldn't keep them out. They were deer mice. They found ways to get in, but I developed this fear that they were going to crawl on me when I slept. And it didn't make any sense at all. I was the kind of kid who would run through the mud and try and catch, you know, snakes or anything I could find. I wasn't scared of little creatures. And, in fact, I was trying to set little traps to catch these field mice alive with no success, you know, disappointing success. But then one night I just started having these anxiety attacks that these things would crawl on me when I slept and they would do something, but I didn't know what. And the particular mice I pictured, I don't think I imagined so much as like giant mice, as mice that were going to be so in my face that they were going to look big by the time I opened my eyes. And I remember, you know, beady black eyes was what I expected that I might see, and like I couldn't really see where their mouths were. And it wasn't like the typical kind of gray alien at that point that mm-hmm. that I was a, you know, I wasn't ascribing that particular faith to what I thought was going to be crawling on me. There wasn't anything rational about it, you know. It was just this strange fear that I started to have.
Right. Although listening to you now, and I don't want to speak for you, but looking back at it now, you know, from now, yeah. your vantage point now, looking back at this, and after, especially after what just happened over the next few weeks, and I assume you're familiar with the psychological term of transference?
Transference? Not so much that word.
Okay, I'm thinking in terms of, well, maybe whatever you're seeing, you're trying to put it in common terms of things that you're familiar with. So even if you were seeing something else, you're trying to squeeze that round thing into, like, a square hole. And
yeah.
you would transfer that information or process it in your mind or brain as a mouse when it may not be a mouse. That's what I mean by transference.
I think that is what I was doing, and the strangeness of it never really hit me until I was arguing with my brothers one day as to who was more scared of what, not how. Yeah. I wasn't scared of anything, and he was scared of more things than me, and he made the analogy that my fear of mice was like a woman in some 1950s show, you know, in a skirt jumping up on a chair to get away from a mouse, you know, and that,
right.
you know, that's when it struck me, you know, that was really weird. What in the world would scare me about mice? You know?
Absolutely, because you had said sometime along the road there that you actually used to go out into the field and you were inquisitive about mice as part of your biological search, correct?
Oh, yeah. I would have been happy to find one and try to catch it in my hands and risk getting rabies or it bite me. You know, not that field mice get that very often, but, I mean, I was reckless.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's another thing, because I remember, and then when I did read your novel, by the way, which is, I think I mentioned to you, I thought it was excellent. Very well written, presented from a dialogue point of view, and I was telling Joe before we came on the air that is a very difficult skill to develop. And I know people who try to, it's a skill which it's hard to master. I used to tell people that they were interested in being writers that, you know, you should check out Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. This is a beautiful, a classic novella dealing with really, really good dialogue and getting right to the point, done by a true professional, because he was a journalist, too, besides being a famous novelist. But I saw those same skills in you, in your novel, which hopefully we'll talk before the end of the program, Marshall, about, because I know there's an awful lot in there that mirrors the experiences that you have. But the reason I brought that up right now is because I noticed that you had read a few of authors, including Raymond Fowler, and one of the books Raymond Fowler wrote was The Allagash Abduction, and in that book, the twins in that book, who were the Weiner brothers, they would not speak about their experience in 1973 being abducted with two other men, but they had a series of dreams for 10 years, and finally Jim Weiner got on the horn with his brother and said, you know what, I am having these horrible dreams about these experiences back when we were camping out in the canoe, and his brother said, yeah, I'm having the same dreams.
Mm.
So that's when they started to get to the idea. Maybe, who knows, because they're identical twins, their minds were working on a similar pattern, but they were able to mix and match notes, and then when Raymond Fowler got a hold of them, they were able to piece together the fact that all four of them were abducted by very strange group of insectoid-like aliens, and
yeah.
it involved the night terrors that you spoke to yourself. That's why I'm beginning to wonder if there's a connection with those little mice that you say you saw or felt or were afraid of, and these night terrors that these guys were having when they were dreaming.
Yeah, it's I think I was covering something other than mice, and
Well, there, you along these same times now, you also mentioned that you had developed some type of a paranormal ability, especially with a certain animal. You want to just tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I was. My father was still living in Wappingers Falls, and we didn't live there, but 2 years after we initially moved in, so this would have been very close to the same time. And I would go down to these ponds way back behind his house and catch frogs on the edge of those ponds. And but I didn't have to sneak up and pounce on them with my hand like I used to do. I just sort of would stare at them for a little bit. I would think such thoughts as, okay, I agree not to hurt you and stuff like that. And then I was able to put my hand in the water and kind of slip it underneath them and just lift them out of the water. And I could even go as far as bringing them close to my face and baring my teeth at them and opening my mouth like I was going to bite them. And they still wouldn't flee. And I was able to pass them from hand to hand, as long as they were my own hands sometimes, and they'd stay in my hand. And then I'd transfer it to my brother's hand, and the instant my hand left it, it would be off into the water again. It would jump 3 feet in the water.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like I could have hurt them if I really wanted to, even though I was initially saying, you know, oh, I won't hurt you. I feel like, you know, it would have been gross. I mean, I'm not inclined to, you know, bite a slimy frog or anything, but I feel like I could have done that, and I think it still would have just sat there.
Right, and that was the first time that you ever felt you had that ability, right around that same time, right?
What's that now? I'm sorry.
The ability to freeze a frog, in essence, and keep them immobile if you wanted to. In other words, whatever power you may have had over them, you felt that you actually had that power, and that's why they couldn't move.
Yes. I think whatever those beings had used on me at that point, I was now able to use on a lower animal.
Right. See, this is the point I was trying to make. Yes, exactly. You know, and I hear this all the time over the many years I've been doing research, that whatever it is that they do to you, or the abilities they have, seems to be transferred, no pun intended, to you on even if it's on another level, that, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And it's almost like nothing said, but here you are. You seem to have had that ability, and you proved it to yourself that you actually could do that.
Yeah, and to a couple of my brothers, and at least one of them who remembers me doing it. And I'm not sure whether I could still do it. I mean, I don't really have any interest in trying to. It's kind of like power that is of God. You know, you don't try it out.
Right.
You know, that's in bad form. And then if it's
something
else, well, I don't even want to mess with it anymore. And I don't want other people seeing what I can do and then wanting to go through what I've been through to gain this ability, because it's not worth it.
No, it's certainly not. As a matter of fact, that point is brought out in spades. I'm just reading a book now that Lynn Marzulli recommended. It's called Earth's Earliest Ages by G.H. Pember, P-E-M-B-E-R. And he makes this point in spades in the middle of this book when he starts talking about spiritualism and all of the things that are forbidden about in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, et cetera, et cetera. And the last thing you want to do is get involved with anything that smacks of any of this thing. We would just call it under the blanket name of a cult. But
yeah,
it's all an abomination to the Lord.
Yeah, so, and I didn't think of it that way. Yeah, but I didn't think of it that way at that time, but it was. It really was. And the fact, you know, I was deceived, but that's not really an excuse. I mean, I could have learned my Christian basics, you know, thoroughly. And I could talk about a couple of deficiencies, I think, that were in the some of the Catholic training I had. But primarily, as far as I and Catholics go today, it was what we agreed on that makes a bigger difference, I feel.
Yes,
but
I agree with you, and I'm the biggest critic of my own Catholic training. That it seems like they never told us the real things to be careful of, the things that are going to sidewhack you later on in life, and you're not even prepared for it. That's a whole other discussion. But I seem to recall that while you were in your father's house, you had another thing happen to you, of a paranormal nature. Do you recall that?
What other incident? I'm sorry.
Well, it's had something to do with hearing footsteps or something like that.
Oh yes, yes. There was one particular week staying at the house we eventually moved to after Wappinger Falls.
Okay.
I was staying in one bedroom, and night after night at about 3:01 or 3:02 a.m., I would hear footsteps out in the hallway. There was no carpet on the hallway floor at that time, and
you were hearing these footsteps, and there was on the wood. Now, what happened? Didn't something strange happen after that?
Those experiences concluded with me trying to say a lot of Hail Marys and things to make it stop, and they were not particularly effective. I was saying the Our Father, too, also.
Right.
I was reciting the Our Father. There's kind of a difference between reciting prayer and really praying it, meditating on every line like you really mean what you're saying. And I think, I was doing it wrong, I think. But subsequently, other siblings of mine stayed in the same bedroom, and even after the hallway was carpeted, the footsteps going down the hallway sounded like they were on wood. It was as if the carpet wasn't there, and that is what they described. And we didn't find out that we had experienced the same thing until years later when they happened to mention it.
Yeah, right. And again, that sounds to me like a form of transference. In other words, the sound is not... Well, transference in the sense of it's not going into through your ear, it's going into your mind.
Possibly so. Spiritual phenomena were common in that particular house, and they were actually so common that that was just one of them, really. And it's hard to tell where the haunting thing, you know, ends and the alien abduction thing begins. I would later find out in a contactee experience with my first girlfriend that these beings that contacted her later said that they abducted me from that particular house. And even though I don't specifically recall that, but I didn't have much reason to doubt it. They had proven their ability to edit my memory. And, so it just didn't seem... very non-credible in light of the fact that, in light of all else that I remembered.
Right. Now, you had mentioned that you had gone to Purdue University. Now, what were you preparing to do, or career were you preparing to go into when you entered Purdue?
Population, evolutionary, and genetic biology was my major.
Okay. And how did that turn out?
I wound up having to leave in the middle of my second semester. I did not know that I needed to stick to a certain diet in order for my brain to work right. I've since found that out. I couldn't carry on a conversation back then as I am with you now, staying relatively on topic. And I didn't know it was because of gluten and milk protein, that I need to restrict both of those in my diet very much in order to be able to communicate pretty much like everyone else. And other kids were having a considerable amount of fun harassing me, and there were some paranormal incidents there, such as sensing that something was staring at me from behind, and I would turn around to see nothing there. But then, as I started to read more about UFO literature, because I was getting more interested in UFOs and other unknown phenomena like Bigfoot. But I was reading about pretty much everything. There was one particular night. It was Martin Luther King weekend, and I was surprised at how many other kids could afford to just fly home for Martin Luther King weekend. And but I was there pretty much alone, and I had this dream of being abducted from the middle of nowhere, some place that I've never been, house in the middle of a big flat desert. And that dream ended strangely, but when I woke up, I was in my upper bunk, and I started to lean upwards. I knew something was in the room, and I leaned over to the left to look at what was in the room, and I started to see the top of a bald gray head. And just before I would have seen where the eyes started, if it was the typical gray humanoid, I admit I didn't actually see it. But before I would have seen the big black eyes or whatever, the dream went completely black. Not dream, really. It was my memory of leaning up and looking over to the middle of the room went completely black, like it had been edited. And then I woke up the next morning.
Yeah, that would indicate that perhaps you might have been abducted that night, correct?
Yes. Yes, I think I was. Yeah.
Now, during your Purdue years, you also had a girlfriend there, and didn't something happen with your girlfriend that indicated that she may have been connected somehow to the whole alien dynamic?
I did meet the woman who would eventually be my six-year fiancé at Purdue, but not until much later. Right after I went home from Purdue, in the middle of my second semester, I started living with my mother, and I actually took up a job in a fast food restaurant, which was what I was accustomed to from my high school days. And a girl came in, and I remarked to another coworker that I thought she was kind of cute, and they said, well, go up and talk to her, you know, because they knew how I was a very shy person. They kind of goaded me into going up and trying to be more social. I did go up and meet her, and we got to talking, and we agreed to, like, go out on dates and see each other. And that was my first girlfriend, and I was about 19.
And was there something about she was able, either you were able to read her mind or she was able to read your mind?
Yes. One night, we were both kind of, like I say, transportationally challenged, and we had a lot of phone conversations. When we couldn't see each other right then, our schedules didn't jive completely either. And we started to talk about the paranormal one night, and because I was interested in it. And I asked her to close her eyes and try to picture what I was thinking about. And I visualized some common object. I can't remember exactly what it was. And she said she could see a figure that was like a human being, but in her words, she said, you can tell that he isn't one of us. And she told me why she could tell that it was a he, and that and she told me that it had a name. And I got a mental impression at that time of what the name would sound like. Then she told me the name, and in fact, it did sound like similar to the name that had sort of just come into my head right then.
Right.
And
was this a name that you would subsequently use in your novel?
I didn't actually use the same name, but the name that I used in my novel, which was Q-Art, I named the being in my novel Q-Art. It was similar in that it was kind of it sounded like B science fiction. You know, it was kind of hokey, I thought the name was, and
right.
I just kind of played along. I had read other UFO literature in which people had claimed to have contact with aliens that, like Andromeda Rex, you know, things that I would not think were alien names, and not my idea of what an alien name should sound like. It should sound like something that, no human could pronounce if it was truly alien. And but I just sort of played along because I'd read about this. And I had a feeling that whatever this being was, it wanted me to accept what was told me. And it wanted me to give it the benefit of the doubt just because it was a whoop-de-doo alien. And so I kind of played along just so I could find out more.
Yeah. Now, somewhere along the line, I don't know if it was while you were at Purdue or maybe soon after that, you met a woman by the name of Gretchen, a Christian woman, and now how did she figure into your story, and what did she tell you that might have been significant?
Yeah, I met a girl that that I refer to as Jody in the written testimony.
Right.
I met her at my job where I worked, and she was amenable to come out with me, which I had never asked a girl out before. I think I had Asperger's disorder. In fact, I've got pictures from around the time I graduated high school where nobody would doubt that I had Asperger's disorder. It was very quiet. I seldom spoke. Yeah. But I approached her, and we got to have a conversation, and we started going out. We shared a lot of telephone conversations. The subject in one of these phone conversations turned to the paranormal, and I tried to get her to picture what I was thinking. And what she closed her eyes and started to see and started to describe to me was a being that was like a human, but as she put it, you could tell that it wasn't one of us.
Wow. Now, because of your previous experiences, were you a little bit astounded at the fact that she was picking up things from your mind regarding quote-unquote alien beings?
Well, I didn't think she was picking it up from my mind. I thought back to the literature that I had read, and I'd seen the top of one of their heads before, but otherwise, I didn't think that she was reading my mind. I thought that she was being contacted at that point.
Oh, okay, so the aliens could talk to your girlfriend, and she would pass along the information that they were providing to her. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, what were some of the things that they were telling her that you found out about?
They gave her a name. I call it Q-Art in the book, the name of the alien, and I call the planet Quartzon, even though those were not the real names. The names to me sounded kind of hokey, like grade B science fiction. I didn't really believe, but I accepted what I was told because I was happy to be getting any communication at all, and I realized there was literature out there that I had read that in which the aliens gave similar names that sounded kind of hokey, like I said, grade B science fiction.
Okay. Okay, now we're getting down almost to the last 10 minutes, Marshall. I just want to, I know that you met another woman that had an effect on you. I think her name was Gretchen or something like that. If you could just speak to her about her a little bit and just give me an idea of how you were trying to piece all of this together with your girlfriend and meeting Gretchen and what did she have to say and that kind of thing, okay?
Okay. Yeah, it was months later after I was forced to go home on medical leave from a fucking job that I was starting to make mistakes. My medical issues that I did not understand at that time were catching up with me. I found myself with a lot of time to talk to a Christian neighbor lady who had immigrated from Germany. Not the sort of person I would expect to be able to convince me about the Gulf South where I moved to starting to get back to my Christian roots. But I did listen to her, and she related an experience where she woke up to see three tall, two by them as fallen angels.
Up just a little bit. You're starting to fade a little bit, if you could, okay? Trying to show you because of her experiences with did she describe these? I didn't hear you clearly enough, but did she describe these beings as being like fallen angels?
That is how she described them.
Okay, now after you had your experience with Gretchen, did you go on at your own search as to try to put all of these pieces together at that point?
I did subsequently see them on one particular night, and I blew myself out of it seemed like a morgue set, and I found myself trying to put some of their equipment back together, and I was brought to see one of the beings inside with the large eyes. I'm trying to go through the story quickly now. I know no time's limited. But it wound up being that I changed the voice of one of my female supervisors from work for the psychological effect of trying to dominate me. Just trying to get me to agree with such statements as they had the right to do anything they wanted to me. I was silent. I did not respond. When they got to the part about where they were going to try to recalibrate the equipment, I just said, okay. Recalibrate the equipment to be able to sustain me. I just said, okay, but I felt privately that if this ever happened again, I was going to start reducing everything that I bought, the drawings I bought, just like I destroyed that equipment they were using. The best out. We were trying to gauge the safety of interacting with these devices. I call it the green simulation. I don't know what else to call it.
Right.
It's designed to test whether I could fall on the power of God and start with the instead. And I did, but all I destroyed was the computer, so it simulated the supernatural energy.
Mm-hmm. By the way, the name of Marshall's novel is called The Non-Event Principle. And the theme, which takes a while to develop, really does have to do with how these beings trick us in a form of virtual reality. But you would swear for the life of you that it was real. And I remember... there was a book by Ed Walters, I think out of Florida, Joe, and he actually wrote a book about abductions based on the that very famous case down there in Florida, the Gulf Breeze.
Yeah,
and then he wrote a subsequent abduction about his own abduction that he said he was put through a whole series of virtual realities that you could swear they were real. And what they were trying to do is elicit emotions from him because of the reality of the situation. So I'll never forget that. I don't know I remember the exact name of the book, but it kind of deals with the things that Marshall traverses in his novel. And that's one of the reasons it's called by the name of it, the non-event principle. But it really makes you think about what is really going on here and how we are all perhaps fooled with when you're dealing with supernatural entities that have certain abilities to do things in order to present us with the things that perhaps we are taking as real but that are not real or are manifesting in a different way. We're starting to see that right now, too, with the whole subject of holograms and holographs and who knows. We remember there was a gentleman on, well, actually, Dr. Chuck Missler, he actually thinks that the Phoenix Lights was a experiment in hologram for whatever that's worth. Unfortunately, there is very few ways to go about proving that what you're seeing is not real or how is it real. So it's a very interesting subject, and if you're dealing with nefarious beings, then there is it only gives us more reason to be cautious. And I know when I have done my research on apparitions, regardless of the apparition, be very, very careful about these things. If you actually read a book called The Miracle Detective by Randall Sullivan, he actually investigated Medjugorje and found out an awful lot of things that would make one extremely cautious that we may not be seeing the Blessed Virgin Mary, and this could be a setup by the Queen of Heaven. And the Queen of Heaven, as anyone knows who reads the Bible, in the seventh chapter of Jeremiah, we're talking about Diana, Isis, Ishtar, all of these fertility goddesses, which are nothing more than representations of the fallen angels. This is what we're being warned about in the Old Testament. Why should things be any different now? So when I read Marshall's book, I remembered those things about how it's so easy to con people who are not aware of what the real thing may be. You know, what do you think about that, Joe?
I've been seeing a lot of that for years, and one thing that I when I work with people that I try to have them aware of is when they're testing the spirits on them, look at the messages that they bring, and the key is always in the message. And in between these testimonies and the messages that we're getting through this types of deception, it pretty much tells, you know, who we're dealing with. Especially with the Mary sightings, you know, they seem very Christian in the type of message that they bring, but look what they're proposing, you know, is the whole focus on Mary and Jesus himself. You know, where he's and he's our the God himself, God the Father. And that's one thing that you have to be careful of is when we start looking at some things that seem spiritual or Christian in nature, but when you get right to it, it's just more of the, you know, muddied water.
Yeah, that's right. And then, so we're almost out of time. I'd just like to say in as a final thought, and this is from 1 Corinthians, ye cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the cup of demons. Demons, therefore, are worthless to us and should be cast away in any form that they may take. So having said that, Joe, I just would like to say, and if Marshall, I just want to thank you for taking the time out to be on the program. Maybe we'll have you back on under better circumstances. And, Joe, I want to thank you for bringing Martha
on. Thank you, Byron.
And, yeah, and hopefully we'll have a few more people for next month to continue with giving daring testimony to the truth under the Cursed Net Breakthrough Radio.